and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
Hi, this is Al McFarlane, host of The Conversation with Al McFarlane. You're listening to 90.3 FM, KFAI, Minneapolis.
Did I burn down for you?
At rondoblockparty.com. That's www.rondoblockparty.com. Get on our email list, peruse to the site, and see all the activities we have lined up for this year's fourth annual Rondo Block Party, which is Saturday, August 1st, from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the Rondo Commemorative Plaza, 820 Rondo Avenue.
So we should say the restored Rondo Avenue. When the highway came through, it went ahead and they took out Rondo Avenue and renamed the portion that stayed on this side of the highway. So it was able to be restored to Rondo Avenue. And the Rondo Commemorative Plaza is here with our code. We are the administrator of the plaza. The plaza is the first monument of its kind. It is the first monument to Black and brown communities in which they used urban development to decimate the community. So a mm-hmm. highway went through or new buildings or something like that. That's happened in about 2,000 Black and brown communities across the country. And so this represents here in St. Paul, here in the Rondo community, the first monument to that. That's a testament to the resilience of the community.
It's a perfect location for the Rondo Block Party.
Okay. Well, let's go back. You were sharing the history of Rondo. Let's go into the whys. I mean, I think that in light of the fragility of the political, cultural environment right now, nationally, internationally, it's always appropriate to talk about why things were the way they were. And you made reference to highway construction as part of they called it urban renewal, we called it urban removal, the decimation of Black housing stock, of Black wealth. And, you know, I guess I think we ought to spend some time critiquing why they did it. You know, and they'll never say it, but John, Ronald, what do you think? What was behind the highway movement and the destruction of Black Wall Street, of Wilmington, of Rondo, of North Minneapolis? What was the prevailing thought? And Jonathan, you mentioned it, but go sit deeper into that if you would.
What the idea here is that you've got to really understand it, you got to go back to the roots of slavery. And you got to look at what happened with that. A lot of people don't realize that the transatlantic slave trade started the global economy. It was the thing that produced revenue across the globe that enabled countries to establish trade. It even established some countries and city-states. What you had happening with that is that the majority of exports from the U.S. became out of slavery. Cotton, sugar, all of the resources that made the U.S. a global superpower came from the quote-unquote free labor that was being provided. And so when you have the Civil War and the ending of slavery, what you get is African Americans establishing communities for themselves, trying to develop businesses, trying to make a way in the world, but you're 264 years behind the eight ball, that you're trying to pick up the pieces and build things from that. However, we saw with Reconstruction being just a short period in history because of the fact that there was so much animosity, so much hatred that still existed with the white community. They did not want there to be success. They came up with the Black Codes, which were laws during the Jim Crow era that went ahead and penalized African Americans for everything from not having a job to not having a grandfather who had voted or who owned land or things like that. So there were a series of laws that went ahead and restricted our ability to succeed. And so as you get forward into the 30s and the 40s in the Rondo community, you've got thriving businesses. You have the Pullman Porters and the Red Caps, which enabled the communities to establish a middle class. You have organizations that were coming up that made sure that there were resources in the community, and the powers that be just couldn't have that. It comes down to racism. In fact, in 2015, there was a Rondo healing ceremony, and the mayor at the time, Chris Coleman, issued an apology on behalf of the city and on behalf of the mayor's office for the highway, and said this was racism, plain and simple. This was not about progress. This was not about transportation. And Charles Zelli, who was the commissioner of the Transportation Department for Minnesota, also issued an apology. But the mayor put money in his budget, $40,000, for the Rondo Commemorative Plaza. So he put his money where his mouth is, but it really recognized the fact that when they made this decision, they were looking at going ahead and setting back this community and destroying that. And efforts like what the Rondo Block Party does is symbolic of community that comes together, of the resilience of Rondo, of the ability to celebrate the heritage and culture through the kinds of adversity that gets thrown at us.
And if I may add to what Jonathan said, is that they kind of had a forward thinking process. They knew if they split up, if they divided, if they desecrated the Rondo community, predominantly Black community, it was going to have a devastating impact on the potential generational wealth that could have been created from that community. So they knew it was going to impact them, not only then, but even for the future. Mm-hmm. And we're still impacted by it today. So they had a plan in place, without a doubt. Straight racism, straight jealousy, because they saw what the Rondo community was creating in terms of the number of businesses, owning our own homes, owning our own businesses. And then just, you know, it was a planned attack. Exactly what it was, a planned attack.
So let's talk about resilience then. How do you see us surviving? How would you describe the capacity, the gift, the genius of survival that characterizes African Black people that came through the period of slavery and also through Jim Crow, and who persist and at one level or another continue to thrive even today, and even in this environment, which is openly anti-Black? One of the things that I'm liking a lot, Jonathan and Ronald, when I watch social media, I'm hearing more and more and more of our people calling out racism. And in the past, we had sort of a double code, a double-mindedness. On the one hand, we knew what they were doing, that it was detrimental to us and insincere. What they were doing was always contradicting what they said was the ideal of democracy and governance and inclusion, because while the standard was right and great, the practice was absolutely opposite. They shielded or blocked us from opportunity and from our own development, right? And it was malicious and pernicious, I guess is the right word. What I'm hearing a lot now, brothers, is more of the social media people in particular calling it out and not being afraid and no longer willing to be polite, or no longer willing to be, what's the right word for it, extra sensitive to other people's feelings. And so I think that's a good sign of continued maturation, you know, and confidence building on our part. And I say that because Bobby and I, we watch this, my wife Bobby and I watch the news all the time, and between us we'll sit and say, you know what, this thing looks like it's heading to some violence against us. Looks like they want to rally themselves to a place where they once again justify, you know, mass, what's the right word for it, a push against our community. And at the same time, we're saying, but we know things are different and that our people aren't going to accept it. We never did. But we have the ability to show each other not accepting it, not fighting back, thereby amplifying our individual and collective success as we move against those forces that seek to dominate, destroy, and marginalize our people. In doing so, that seek to disserve humanity itself. Jonathan, I'll keep going on, but jump in, Jonathan.
So one of the things that I think people don't realize is part of the legacy of Martin Luther King, one of our fellow alumnus from Morehouse, but Dr. King led the civil rights movement. And one of the key legacy points that many people miss is the ending of terrorism in America that is unaddressed around African Americans. Prior to the civil rights movement, a white person could walk in your house, kill you, and walk away and get off scot-free. What you saw come out of the civil rights movement was a level of accountability. You saw laws that went ahead and addressed the 14th Amendment, the citizenship that we had, but was not being enforced. You began to see things like the desegregation of schools, and each time period where you have major events that involve media, you see a step forward. Part of what happened in the civil rights movement is people saw on TV water hoses, dogs, batons, all of that being used against our people. And they said that this doesn't make any sense. This isn't what America is supposed to be. You know, if it's not visible, then people can hide from it. You see a step forward with the Rodney King video back in the 90s, and you see progress happening and citizens coming out and organizing. George Floyd's murder being caught on video, that ignited a powder keg around the world of people of all races coming together and saying, this isn't right. This isn't fair, and we won't stand for this. And so you saw this next iteration of people coming and standing up and saying, we're not going to sit down anymore. We're not going to go ahead and allow you to be racist, to be cruel, to be mean, to attack us without it being answered. And you saw support from allies all across the globe coming out and having protest, and you saw again some advancement. Now again, we're seeing this pushback, this attempts by the president to go ahead and rewrite history again by removing things from the Smithsonian and other museums. trying to go ahead and put disclaimers on the Smithsonian right now. It is almost laughable saying that this represents not the true story. And it all goes back to Kellyanne Conway and alternative facts with the first Trump campaign. That introduction of you can have an alternative fact, another way of looking at things, mm-hmm. which was fake, false, not real, but it opened up this idea that allowed people who came from a more racist and a more conservative viewpoint to say, well, that's the way you're looking at it. No, this is what is true, and what you're coming up with is not true. Mm-hmm. But there's this peace all around the world where they're still looking at, oh, well, maybe there is another way to look at that. And you see things such as, I'm going to go back to the Bloc Party, that are so important because you have people coming together in community, people celebrating our community and celebrating our heritage and history. And it makes such a difference when you get to the media and the national stage and people being able to look at that. Ron, what do you think in terms of, you know, how that means something special for our community?
Before you answer, Ron, let me shout out Susan Budig for liking on our Facebook channel. So if you're checking us out on Facebook or LinkedIn or on any of the YouTube platforms that we're streaming to, drop us a note. Let us know where you're watching from. We shouted out, I think, a few minutes ago, another listener. A viewer who Bliss Alliance 54, who said that she was watching the show from Duffy Shop of Leather. So Bliss Alliance 54, thank you, and thank you for the comments that you made, and we'll share those as we go along. And if you want to be on the program, there's a QR code here at the top of the screen. Click on, we'll see you in our waiting room, and we'll invite you in to join this conversation. Ron, go ahead and respond if you would. I know you got to leave a little earlier,
yep.
but take as much time as you can. And I wanted to ask you to tell more about your personal background, how you come to the Rondo. Are you a native of St. Paul?
I am a native of St. Paul. Grew up in Rondo. Actually,
talk about your family. Your family. How your family got to Rondo?
And my dad's from Rondo. Yes. My dad's from Rondo. Rest in peace. And my mother's from Macon, Georgia. Actually, so he married a Southern woman. But grew up in Rondo. Actually, lived on the street where the Rondo Days Parade passed by for several years. And just have always had a love for the neighborhood. And so Rondo's in my blood. And that's why I'm so in tune with what's going on and involved with a lot of the activities that are happening within our community. Because the community right now is thriving. You can see evidence of us bringing that resilience to life. You can see evidence with what Reconnect Rondo's doing, what the Rondo Community Land Trust is doing, with what our code is doing. And we're just new kids on the block trying to bring all these different activities together and create this collaboration, so to speak. I mean, the theme this year is Build the Block, Partnerships in Action. And it's about us coming together as a community, as a one force, because we are much more successful when we work together, when we share each other's resources, when we can actually, you know, hold each other's hands going through trial and tribulation type situations. And so that's really where I see the growth in the Rondo community now. Now, of course, it's changed quite a bit since when I was growing up, but the foundation is still there. And again, the demonstration of the resiliency of our culture, of our community, is being displayed in many different forms today. And we just provide an opportunity for us to celebrate that resiliency through the Rondo Block Party.
One of the things we'll have at the Rondo Block Party is the Legacy Lounge, which will be hosted by the Rondo Roundtable. So the Rondo Roundtable is a collaboration of Rondo organization, legacy organizations and new ones. Ronald's organization is a part of it. R-Code is a part of it. The Rondo, Reconnect Rondo, Central Village. There's a lot of organizations working together to celebrate Rondo, to promote Rondo. And so we will be hosting a legacy lounge primarily focused on seniors right on the center of the plaza, but open to everybody, of course, to showcase the members of the roundtable, what kind of efforts we're going to be doing going forward, and how you can go ahead and be involved and connect on that.
Awesome. Well, we'll come back to that as we go. I wanted to pivot a little bit and Ron, hang on as long as you can.
Yeah.
Just looking at some of the issues that we're looking at and the two things I want to try to connect. One is just the horrific stuff unfolding in Ocean Springs, Mississippi. I want to get your thoughts on what happened with the young man, Wells, and his death and the public attention that's getting, and why it means so much in part is that the game changed significantly because of Minnesota and George Floyd, right? Because of Minnesota and Christine and what's the other gentleman's name that were killed by ICE recently here. So how our justice system works is being put under the lens of the scrutiny of a good watch, a good look by our people. Any reaction, Ronald or Jonathan, about what happened in Mississippi and what the lessons are for our communities here? Here's what I think. Everybody I noticed got a teenage kid, a boy in particular, has to talk to that kid about, because all of our kids are involved in the white community pretty much here in Minnesota. And so what do you tell your teenager about his four or five bros, and most of them probably white kids, and they get along? But when you see what happened in Mississippi, what are you obligated to say to your child, if anything? Ronald, what do you think?
Well, the thing about it is that kids these days, especially teenagers, they have grown up in a society that has dramatically changed compared to, you know, where we grew up in. I mean, social media, the television, all of these media outlets really play a major role in some of the lack of development of our youth, as well as some of the attitudes our youth have seemed to try to take on, because they're brainwashed, in my opinion, to a degree, what is happening around them based off of what they're seeing, like I said, in social media and in television. And so the one thing that I actually have two adults. I can't speak on teenagers right now, but I have two adults that are children. And you know, they both understand, you know, what they've come up through in terms of growing through a lot of the pains and some of the murderous situations that they see on TV. And it's a shame that, you know, a lot of our youth just don't get it. And it's hard to try to connect to them. I teach young kids coding, elementary and middle school kids, and just that experience in itself has opened my eyes just to see how far behind our youth are, how they have not really grasped the reality of what life has in front of them. And so I always try to preach to them and provide them with some knowledge about, you know, life right now for you is fun and games. Life right now for you may not be as serious as you think it should be, but at some point you're going to have to learn how to take care of yourself, because you can't continue living under mama and daddy's household for the rest of your life. And so the point I'm trying to make is that we need to really instill in our youth at a young age about what's ahead of them when it comes to living, when it comes to doing right versus wrong, when it comes to understanding what kind of impact they can have on the future of their peers, their parents, the people that surround them. They need to really understand that they need to get out of this funk of a mindset that everything is a game, everything is fun and fun activities, and get serious about life. I mean, because a lot of times it's the company that you keep, or sometimes it's the places that you are, that really causes you to find yourself in these situations that are just impossible to get out of.
I think one of the things that is overlooked or not fully understood is the fact that every person, and as you said, every Black family who's got a Black child at some point has the talk. And the broader white community was not aware of that before the murder of George Floyd, and some still aren't. The talk is the conversation with them about what they will run into and what to do in situations such as when you get pulled over by the police, mm-hmm. when you run into a crowd of racist people, mm-hmm. the way that you should react in situations so that that child comes home. I have a daughter and a stepdaughter, and both of them, you know, I've had conversations with, but the daughter, it was really her that I had to sit down and say, here's what's going to happen. You're going to run into these situations. When you do, here's how you react. Here's where you place your hands on the steering wheel. Here's how you talk to the officer. And it's sad that in 2026, you know, white families, when they talk about the talk, they're talking about the birds and the bees. Black families, we're talking about how to come home safe. And it's not generally realized that exists here in this country. And from that, what we have is an idea of how do you go ahead and ensure that young people are prepared for the world? How do you ensure that they have the knowledge that they need to go ahead and advance? And to understand that they're not going to be treated the same. Nolan Wells, you know, whatever friendship he had with the people he went out to the island with, I don't know, I can't say or anything, but it is always suspicious when you're down in the South and the one Black person ends up injured, ends up dead, and everybody else is white, and there is a concern right there about how that happens. If those boys were really his friends, they would understand that he could not be left someplace on an island by himself. The risk is too great, especially in Mississippi, for us. So you have to ask yourself, how close of a friends were they really? Mm-hmm. Were they really tight enough to look out for his best interests? Or is there something more nefarious that has happened here? And are they involved in some way?
I'd be curious to know how people in this community in Minnesota feel about that. And as I said, I don't know anybody that doesn't have a lot of white people at one level or another in their lives, either at work or at school, you know, perhaps in athletics.
In their family.
And in Minnesota, in their family. You know, a lot of us have white people in our families. I do. So the question then becomes, how do we raise our Black children so that, as you said, Ron, they have the tools to navigate, they have an understanding and awareness, and in a way that allows them to be confident, clear, and bold, but not double-minded, where they have to code switch, you know, to be one way around white people and another way around and among our own people. How do we do that? And how do you do that? So as I continue with this conversation, I'm thinking of, is it the poet or the author? I think it was, I don't know if it was Maya Angelou or might have been the author out of Chicago, but she was being interviewed by one of the TPT, mega interviewer host a few years ago in North Carolina, and he asked her about white friends. Do you have any white friends? So she said, yeah, I don't know if I have any white friends. Here's what I do know. It's not a question of whether a white person will betray you. The only question is when. Mm-hmm. What circumstances will trigger the betrayal? And it's the betrayal that you can count on. Does that resonate with you at all? And how do you put that into this conversation? How I put it into this conversation is that I think about, my children and my grandchildren. And the question is, how do you say to them in a way that's responsible that you have to be aware and that you have to be aware of the possibility of betrayal? Now, to fail to say that, then you expose the child to what Nolan Wells experienced. Kind of guard down, thinking everything's going to be okay. And as it turned out, it's a fatal flaw. Ron, what do you think?
Well, I can only speak for myself. And I grew up with white friends. I went to elementary school. I went to a couple of white schools. I went to St. Paul Academy, which was all white. Went to Groveland Mac, which was all white. As a matter of fact, I had a white friend that lived on Summit Avenue that we were real tight. And over my years of living, I have not, again, speaking for myself, fortunately, I have not crossed a number of times that I can't count on one hand where I've experienced some form of obvious racism. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of it just had to do with me personally. Mm-hmm. Just my, not to say that I'm someone special, but I am, but just to understand how to communicate with people of other races outside of your own, for one, mm-hmm. as well as how to not take a strong point of emotional response in a manner that really shows your vulnerability. When it comes down to, the differences in race. And so over the years, I've learned to get along with white people, knowing that they could be, as soon as I turn my back, they might have a knife at it. Mm-hmm. I understand that. So I've always been cognizant of the fact that, a lot of white folks can, smile in your face, and as soon as you turn around, they got a frown. I know that. I realize that. I was not naive to any of that. But it's just a matter of how you carry yourself, how you learn to adapt to different situations at moment's notice. And it's not like kissing butt or changing up your attitude, your persona. It's just a matter of knowing when to act in a certain way when you're around a certain environment or a certain group of people.
I grew up on the East Coast, mostly, before coming out here. And my parents actually got married when it was still illegal in this country. They got married in 1966, a year before Loving versus Virginia. And my father was a white Southern Baptist from Columbus, Mississippi, who married a black Catholic woman from Chicago, Illinois. And when my grandfather came up from Mississippi to stop the wedding, we joke, we don't know if it's the race or the religion that was the bigger issue in that one. But what happens, I think, is the connection with white people is the more they get connected to and the more they experience what black and brown people really are versus what they've seen on TV or in movies or things like that, it changes the perspective. My grandfather, my father's mother, by the time she died, was closer to my mom than she was to her own kids, because they had grown close over time, and they had so much that resonated in common, and it took time to figure that out.
Do you know if your grandfather's predecessors were slaveholders?
Yes. I have found slaveholders back in our roots. We've also found on both sides. I found slaveholders on my father's side. I found enslaved people on my mother's side, and putting it's really tricky putting that piece together. I mean, the first time I came across that was in an old booklet from the 80s that one of my distant relatives put together. And I'd taken that from my parents. I was putting the genealogy together, and I came across one of them where the way they identified who was the father and who was the son and that they were connected, instead of census records or birth records, they used slave ownership. The father had gifted a slave to the son, and that's how they established the relationship between the two. And that was the first time I came across that, and it smacks you in the face when you are a biracial person, because of the fact that even though we're biracial, the world considers us black. If you have one drop of black blood, they consider you black, they treat you black. And it's been a battle to be able to hold both sides of my heritage up and tell people that, no, I'm going to honor my Scottish roots and I'm going to honor my African-American roots. I'm not going to honor the slaveholding roots, but I'm going to go ahead and recognize that that's part of the past and part of the life that I bring forward. And then what can be learned from that? We can take that and turn that into a lesson for people to understand how out of tragedy can come growth and can come resilience. One of the things that has happened in Minnesota with it being as white as it is, I've got great white friends and they're people that I've grown to trust. But I've also taught them a lot about what it means to be a black person here. I help put together a conference every year of nonprofit leaders, and we usually do it someplace up north so that you're getting out of the cities, you're getting away from your environments, and it's a summit and retreat, and we have about 75 nonprofit leaders. And when I drive to that, I drive in a suit. And they asked me one time, why aren't you in shorts? Why aren't you driving up here? Things, and I had to explain to them, if I am in a suit and I get pulled over, I'm going to get a better experience and be treated better than if I am in casual clothes. Mm-hmm. And they had no idea that I had to do that in order to come to this conference where we all celebrate nonprofits and be a part of things together.
That's that adaptation. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let me make a huge pivot here because you mentioned Scottish ancestry, and we may have had this conversation before, but when you watched the movie Sinners, what were your thoughts? And I'm particularly interested because the Irish-Scottish thing and the question of the people showing up, the vampires showing up in a... Irish culture or Scottish culture. Jonathan, what are your thoughts about that?
One, I love the movie. And it was phenomenal. Should have won more awards, but I'm glad for the ones that it did. I thought that the characterization of the vampires wanting more than just blood, but to absorb the culture. I thought it was allegorical for the United States. What you see so much of what makes us rich as a country is the diversity and the cultures that exist here. The indigenous population, the immigrant populations, the black and brown communities that exist here are so rich and vibrant. And we've seen historically white communities trying to absorb that, trying to, Marco Polo traveling across the world looking for spices. So was Columbus. And all of these searching for our culture, the wanting to learn our dance moves, wanting to learn how we cook things and things like that. There was so much realism in that trying to absorb our culture and the fact of our culture being passed through music. And so I thought it was very rich. It's not part of Irish or Scottish lore trying to absorb it, but there was some truth in that, because you get pieces like the origins of the Ku Klux Klan comes out of some Celtic origins and pieces that come over from Scotland and get warped when they're over here and transform into that organization. So I thought it was spot on, and just such a rich take on what has been tried time and time again in terms of trying to steal the spirit, trying to steal the soul of the African-American community and the other communities of color, and absorb that and then use that and take that as their own. You see some of the earliest heroes, the pulp heroes, the Shadow, Tarzan, all of these ones are white people who go to other cultures and learn the secrets. And then they come back and they are better than the average white person. You get that a lot in the first half of the 20th century. And I could talk forever about that. But when you look back at some of those early ones, a lot of it involves absorbing culture. So Sinners was just so spot on.
Yeah, I thought also, too, which was intriguing, was how it demonstrated the multicultural activity amongst not only the vampires, but those were the victims of the vampires. I mean, you had black, you had brown, you had Asian, you had white. And that was intriguing to me in terms of just the way it was crafted during those gruesome scenes that occurred throughout Sinners. So yes, it was a very good movie.
Let me fast forward to what both of you guys, and you can tie this back into the Rondo discussion we're having. I'm interested in our sense of the future. What lies ahead? Ron, what are you telling your children and grandchildren to expect? You said part of the duty that we have as black dads, as black fathers, is to give guidance and direction and to prepare young people to navigate, you know, mm-hmm. difficulties that may lie ahead. But are we also preparing them to navigate the joy and the freedom that may lie ahead, that must lie ahead? I believe that we continue on a path towards the discovery and the implementation of freedom for our people. And for me, that means for all people, for all human beings. And so how do we raise our children so that they are motivated by the potential of seeing freedom unfurl for every living person? And what does that mean when you place that potential against the structure, the society, the social structure, which seeks to preserve itself? And what it's seeking to preserve, from my point of view, is a system that is glued by white supremacist thought and ideology, an effort to extract the value of both the planet and other human beings for the benefit of the few and at the expense of the many. Jonathan, what do you think?
That is the key point. It is helping people to understand the white supremacist system we live in and how it has overlaid everything in our country. People don't realize that. When you start talking about white supremacy, people think you're just talking about people in hoods or neo-Nazis, and they don't realize how much of that has been a part of American life and culture since before any of us were born. You look at the system that was set up here, and the idea of things like reparations. When people talk about reparations, people get angry. Well, you know, well, black people just want some money and everything, and they don't stop and think about the fact that we built this country. America is a country built by stolen people on stolen land. And what was taken from the indigenous population, what was taken from the African-American population, it is immeasurable. And so when you're talking about reparations, you're not talking about give me a check for what my ancestors went through. You're talking about, do you realize how much money and wealth was denied our community because our labor went into building companies, Boston Scientific, the larger companies across the world, Georgetown University. There are places that are starting to recognize what was done. The insurance industry built on insuring the bodies of people who were three-fifths of a person. The list goes on, and people don't stop to look at how much of that built the cities and the towns and the industries that exist today. So when we're talking about reparations, we're not talking about, hey, pain and suffering. We're talking about, hey, we built a lot of things that have enabled other people to prosper. And if you looked just at what was lost in Rondo, that was 700 African-American homes, 300 businesses, and 270 million in home ownership. And that is just from the 60s. Go back to 1619. And try to calculate that.
Right.
It's Ron, wrap it up with you. We've got about 2 minutes left, and you can respond to that. But also make sure you invite people again to the block party.
Indeed. Well, Jonathan has said it so eloquently, and there's not a whole lot more to really add to what he's already spoke on. But it is, you know, an area that I think a lot of, again, I always go back to the young folks that they are clueless. They need to really step up their game. They need to understand the history and how it impacts today, the present, their present lives as well as their future lives. And I think that's where they fall short. And it makes sense for us as adults to try to drive that mentality into their thinking, into their understanding of how history impacts the future and how it directly impacts their potential growth. If they don't, you know, get with the game, then the game is going to beat them every single time.
Okay. How about the invitation? Invite people.
Again, I would love for everybody to come out this Saturday, August 1st, 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. Enjoy some music, enjoy a huge health and wellness block. Enjoy some kids zone area where we got bounce houses, face painting and so forth. We have over 70 marketplace vendors, both food and non-food vendors. And it's just going to be a crazy, enjoyable time. We actually have several dance teams that will be performing, the most we've ever had. And that usually is the highlight of our entertainment, is seeing these young ladies, young men, drill and drum dancers, drill and drum teams get out and perform in front of a lovely audience. And so it's going to be exciting. Saturday, August 1st, 11 a.m. to 6 p.m., 820 Rondo Avenue in St. Paul, the Rondo Commemorative Plaza.
Give them the website again.
Thank you for reminding me. www.rondoblockparty.com. R-O-N-D-O. The word block, the word party, all one word, .com.
And it's Ronald also Jarvis, our code under events.
And Jonathan Palmer, brothers, thank you both. What a wonderful conversation. I'm Al McFarland. We'll see you next time.
Thank you for having me.